they found Riyad Boutchakar guilty of all 8 charges, which Mr. Boutchakar had originally pleaded not guilty to.
I don't know if he even understands what he did. I don't think there is anything to forgive, because I don't think that anybody in their right state of mind would have done that.
So do you feel anger towards him?
No. It's not going to change anything.
The first thing I seen was the knife, and the man went with the knife, and he was in a stab of motion. So I just took off across the street, screaming, he's stabbing the children.
Welcome to All Rise. I'm Aisling Moore, radio producer.
And I'm Frank Graney, News Talk's courts correspondent.
Yesterday, the jury found Riyad Boutchakar guilty on all counts. He'll be sentenced on a later date, but today we're going to bring you a special episode.
Yeah, we're going to pore over some of the key evidence, give our thoughts on how things unfolded in Court 19, and we'll also bring you the bits the jury didn't hear.
This is All Rise, the Riyad Boutchakar trial. Welcome to episode 17, Unsung Heroes. 8 charges, 8 guilty verdicts. And I think it's fair to say the dust is still settling and there's still plenty to talk about. And to that end, I'm delighted to say we are joined by 2 other journalists who've covered the entire trial. Deborah Naylor, courts correspondent with Virgin Media News, and Owen Reynolds, courts reporter at Ireland International News Agency. Thank you both very much for coming in this evening. It's been a long 4 weeks for all of you who are in the courts every day, but we do appreciate having you here to tease out some of the things that we couldn't talk about during the trial, some of the things that the jury didn't hear, and what was a really gripping case, I think, a very compelling case with lots of interesting elements to it. Frank, we've reached the end of the trial. Your immediate reaction when that jury returned those unanimous guilty verdicts on all 8 counts?
It all happened very quickly in the end. I think we were closely approaching 4 o'clock yesterday when the jurors were going to be sent home. It was about 3:30, I think, when the jury minder came in, nodded to the court staff, and word quickly filtered out that a verdict was imminent. So at that point, with about 30 minutes left, you were kind of thinking it wasn't going to happen. And the jurors had been in and out looking for various pieces of evidence, transcripts, exhibits and whatnot. So they were going through it. We didn't know how quickly. We had absolutely no idea how quickly they were getting through it. There was a kind of a sense that maybe it would be kicked into next week because they couldn't sit on the Thursday and Friday of this week. One of the jurors was unavailable. So when it came in, it took me by surprise anyway. The room quickly filled up. And you kind of have that moment, even having sat through all of the evidence and developing opinions and views in relation to them. And I mean, I had been satisfied, you know, as somebody sitting through all of the evidence presented by the prosecution and the defence's counterclaims in relation to some of it, I was satisfied that he was guilty and the case had been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. But clearly I had no say in the work of the jury. But you still have that kind of niggling doubt. And this is with every case, you know, even the more clear cut ones, I find there's always that niggling doubt, and juries can't surprise you. But when they came back and found him guilty on all counts, there was a real sense of relief in the room from the public gallery. Leanne Flynn, one of the key prosecution witnesses, and let's not forget that she was also one of the people that Riyad Boutchakar stabbed that day. She was there, parents of some of the children, they were also there, and it was just a real sense of relief. The judge had asked for silence when the verdicts were delivered, and he got that. I think, you know, the public gallery, everybody respected that and just carried themselves with the same dignity as they did throughout the trial, and that could not have been easy for them, because there were days in there where I felt like screaming, and I'm sure they did too.
Yeah. My niggling doubt came when we were talking about the summation by the judge and the focus on intention. That's where I started to go, oh, this might make it harder for the jury to decide on intention, because he was so descriptive as to what that level needed to be. But in the end, the verdict came through. Deborah, if you were to describe the atmosphere in the court when those verdicts came in.
Well, I think as Frank has already described there, it was very quiet. I think when the verdicts came in, It was certainly one of, you could sense the relief. I don't think there was anything other than that. I don't think that these verdicts were in any way unexpected. I actually didn't feel the same tension that you would often feel when a jury returns. As Frank said, there is always that niggling doubt. But I think in this case, there would have been absolute shock if there hadn't been guilty verdicts on all eight counts. I think that was pretty certain. And I think the families carried themselves with the exact same decorum that they did throughout the trial. And that was evident from the very first day of evidence. Straight after the case opened, I can remember the mother of the five-year-old girl who was most seriously injured that day. And she referred to Riad Bhushkar when she was in the witness box as a gentleman. And that just really struck me. I'm like, you know, what that man was accused of doing to her child, and, you know, to have that level of to give him that dignity and to carry herself in the way she did. But that was the same with so many witnesses in this case. It was the same with Leanne Flynn. She was so factual and so composed in the witness box, and that same composure was there yesterday.
There was a lot of humanity on display throughout everything that happened that day. And I think from what I've heard in the court as well, Owen, would that be fair to say?
In terms of the family's reactions to what happened, absolutely. I mean, they sat there and they sat through some very harrowing evidence in particular, you know, and they watched CCTV footage, which cannot have been easy when they saw how close their own children had come to suffering similar injuries or potentially worse. But they retained their decorum. They gave the court process the dignity that it requires and that is needed in that process. And Riad Bhushkar, in fairness, got every, you know, opportunity that the courts could afford him in terms of making out a defence and putting forward a defence to the crimes that he'd committed.
Mm-hmm. The 4 hours and 40 odd minutes, 46 minutes, I think, did that surprise you, Frank, the length of time? Because it sounds like everybody who sat through the trial was quite confident this would be a guilty verdict, but the duration that it took them to get to eight verdicts, mm-hmm, and all unanimous.
Yeah. It was, I think from memory, it was 4 hours and 42 minutes. So, you know, given the amount of evidence, given the fact that there were alternative verdicts in relation to the attempted murder charges, there was a lot for the jury to consider. But this was a diligent jury. And I don't think that they went into that jury room with a blank page. You know, obviously conversations are being had throughout the course of the trial. They're told not to make their minds up until they go out and everybody has a say. And but look, we're human beings at the end of the day. We analyse witnesses and pieces of evidence as they're presented to us. So I think the jury, even subconsciously and probably, you know, without really kind of expressly discussing it, on breaks and whatnot, they had already probably started deliberating in relation to a lot of it. But you still kind of felt that, you know, it would take a long time for them to come back. Yeah. Even as I say, when the evidence to us seemed so clear cut. Juries surprise you. You know, I've been at trials hearing months of evidence and you assume they'd be out for days, they come back in a couple of hours. You can be covering a short trial and juries can be out for days on end. And sometimes, and we never know for sure, given, I suppose, the sanctity of the jury room, but sometimes that's down to a couple of dissenting members, people who have certain views, and maybe it takes a while to come around, and sometimes you don't get that, you know, that unanimous verdict that the court always wants to receive. So was I surprised when they came back? I was surprised in the sense that we were coming close to going home time, and they would have had 2 days off work, and they were told that they would have been certified for 2 days off work. So thankfully, it didn't come to be that the families would have had to wait another 4 or 5 days for a verdict. So they came back right at the buzzer. And look, as I say, I think, like, in the grand scheme of things, 4 hours and 42 minutes doesn't seem like an awful lot of time when you're considering somebody's freedom, as was the case in Riad Bhushkar and all of the consequences that flow from that. But the evidence was so strong for the prosecution, I think, you know.
Owen, would you be able to identify one witness or one piece of that evidence that you think particularly strengthened the prosecution's case?
Well, like I mentioned already, the thing that I think the jury would have come down to, especially when it comes to the attempted murder charges, they would have had to look at that CCTV footage, because it does demonstrate better than anything else can, and better, much better than any of the eyewitnesses were capable of doing, the level of intent that he had and precisely how he went about what he was trying to do. So I do think that taking into account all the nuance and all the different arguments that were made and so on, sometimes things do boil down to something very, very small like that. And I think this is a case where CCTV evidence was absolutely vital and would have been the most important thing that the jury had to consider. I think, but beyond that, then they had to look at the medical evidence. And, you know, when you see the catastrophic injuries that one of the victims suffered, that has to have swayed them quite a lot as well, when considering whether this man intended to cause harm. Not only did he intend to cause harm, he did cause a massive amount of harm, and he very nearly killed that child. In fact, I think the evidence was that she died at the scene and was revived. I think also you look at the size of the knife that he used, that has to have been compelling to the jury. The fact that this was a 36 centimeter long carving knife. I mean, it was brand new. I don't know if he bought it for this specific purpose, but it was in packaging in his bag, in his rucksack, and this appears to have been the first time it was ever used. So there were so many things. There's the fact also that, you know, from the CCTV footage, you can see him standing for a minute and 40 seconds and really waiting until the street is empty, except for that group of 13 children and Leanne Flynn. But even at that moment, Leanne Flynn is distracted because she is zipping up the coat of one of the children. There's so many things that go to show the level of intent and the level of planning that he was engaging in. I think all of those things combined, but really the CCTV thing, the CCTV footage, you probably don't need to go much beyond that to garner his intent.
Well, that was the massive hurdle that the prosecution had to get over, was intention, because, you know, you really have to step into somebody's shoes, get a sense of what's going on between their ears. And that's a very, very difficult thing to do, because nobody, and Riya Abushakar included here, goes in to commit a crime and announces their intention in that moment. Mm-hmm. So what the prosecution had to do was it had to prove evidence, present evidence that where they could draw inferences from what Riyad Bushakar had done. And they did so through eyewitness accounts and, as Owen has pointed out, that CCTV footage where you could see, and we did, we all saw this footage, you could see the motions that he used with the knife, the downward strikes that a lot of eyewitnesses described, the certain amount of planning. There was no suggestion that this was premeditated days and weeks beforehand. Intention can be formed in an instant, as the jury was told, but he did wait for his moment. For a minute and 37 seconds at that bus stop. He was in that area for 37 minutes or so. So he was waiting for his moment. And as Owen has pointed out, he waited until Leanne Flynn was distracted. And then that's when he moved in.
Deborah, I read today that, and you guys would have seen this, the attack itself was less than 20 seconds. I don't think people could imagine that so much trauma, the assault, the level of damage that was done could be done in such a short space of time.
Yeah, and I think the first time we heard about the 15 seconds was actually, it was the judge referred to it in legal argument and rulings last Friday. I think we were all really shocked by actually when we heard that it was 15 seconds, because by this point we had heard all of the eyewitness evidence. And a lot of the eyewitnesses estimated that this attack went on for a few minutes. And I think that really just goes to show, as was conceded by the prosecution at the end, as the defence made the argument, that the fallibility of human memory, and especially when people witness something that's just so traumatising. And I think it was Michael Healy, one of the witnesses, said, you know, he's been asked about the time frame, and he was being asked, sorry, about what he remembered that day and his recollection. And he said, you know, I've replayed this in slow motion over and over in my mind every day since. So to hear then that all that damage could be inflicted in the space of 15 seconds. But the time frame really was key in this trial, because obviously the defence made, you know, a lot out of the fact that once Riyad Bushakar had set Leanne Flynn aside, as they put it, that he had all that time if he wanted to to inflict damage on the other children that were there. But that was actually only a 7 second period before other members of the public intervened. Mm. And I think it really just goes to show again that that intervention, how different the outcome could have been in this case.
I'd love to get your thoughts on that, because it was clear. I mean, we obviously didn't know what the defence's case was going to be, because, I mean, they didn't have to disprove the allegations. It was always on the other side to prove them. And you don't get an opening address from defence counsel in the same way that you do from the prosecution. But as the trial wore on and we were hearing cross-examination of certain witnesses, eyewitnesses, a lot of them were being asked, you know, did you notice a time where Riyad Boushakar essentially had free rein to attack the children once Leanne Flynn had been set aside? And it was almost a suggestion that he was to get credit, or there was something to be read into the fact that in that 7 second period, now the defence would have argued that it was slightly longer, but the judge went and he watched and rewatched this video footage, and he settled on about 7 seconds where Leanne Flynn is cast aside and he has an unimpeded access to the children before members of the public intervened. And the fact that he didn't attack, cause anyone else serious harm, try and kill anybody else in those 7 seconds, was, the defence unsuccessfully argued, indicative of the lack of intent to kill. And it was just something, and there were, like, when you talk about the defence's case, as questions were being asked of witnesses, you were starting to put together what the defence's case was going to be. And then the defence barrister, in his closing speech, was able to pull all of those threads together and present them as their defence in the end.
I think the defence made, you know, it was the very best case that could have been made for Riyad Boushakar. But I think what really went against him is the fact that he didn't plead guilty to any of the charges in this case. And I think it perhaps might have been slightly easier for the jury to consider lesser charges if he had admitted anything, but he didn't even admit to producing a knife that day, although we heard during the trial that it was accepted he did. I think that was summed up very clearly in the judge's charge when he told the jurors that it's about acts, not consequences. So even though two of the children, the 5-year-old boy and the 6-year-old girl, had minor injuries, There was no doubt, I think, in the jury's mind, eventually at the end, there was no doubt in the jury's mind about what actually he intended to do with them. And it was just by the grace of God or luck or whatever your belief system is that those children weren't more seriously injured.
The only other defence that seemed to be put forward beyond intent was inconsistencies in eyewitness accounts, but that didn't seem to really gain much traction at all.
Well, the inconsistencies in eyewitness accounts don't really matter that much. Mm. The injuries that the children suffered are proven by the medical evidence. The assault itself is proven by the CCTV and other evidence, forensic evidence, if it were needed, and the fact that, you know, more or less admissions were made by him that it was him and that he had done these things. So the eyewitnesses were confused, and there's no doubt about that. Some of them thought this went on for minutes when we know it only went on for about 15 seconds. Some of them thought that they saw, after Leanne Flynn was cast aside, that they thought they saw Riyad Boushakar repeatedly stabbing one child in the chest or in the neck or in the stomach area. Now, that clearly didn't happen, but what maybe perhaps they were remembering was seeing him trying to do those things, and maybe then putting two and two together with the newspaper reports about a child being stabbed in that manner and suffering catastrophic injuries. But really, none of that mattered at all, because we know that people's memories are frail, and we know that people are always going to get things wrong. And this is why eyewitness testimony is not as good evidence as often circumstantial evidence is. And certainly it's not as good as CCTV, which is a piece of real evidence that shows exactly what happened rather than somebody's filtered memory of what happened. So the jury wouldn't have been relying on those eyewitnesses, I don't think, at all, in terms of trying to decide what was Boushakar's intention, other than that perhaps all of them seeing this kind of frantic attack on the children perhaps did persuade them that even though more children weren't injured in the way that they seem to have thought they were, that was what he was trying to do, that he wasn't just, as the defence barrister put it at one point, waving the knife in a threatening manner, trying to frighten people, trying to intimidate people. That wasn't his intention. His intention wasn't just to frighten and intimidate. His intention was to kill, and the jury was satisfied with that based on the eyewitnesses and on what they saw themselves on CCTV.
What the eyewitness evidence, I think, really did do in this case is paint such a vivid picture of the scene that day, because I don't think I've covered a trial similar where we've heard from so many witnesses. And I think it was, you know, you were actually really able to picture the scene on Parnell Square East. And there may have been some inaccuracies in what people remembered, but every single person saw him there with the knife. And we listened to some of the witnesses who saw things developing from across the road. We obviously heard from the people who intervened in the attack. I think it was still very strong evidence in terms of building a circumstantial case. And when you took all the other evidence, when you had the concrete CCTV evidence telling you, was showing exactly what happened in the attack, I do think it was very compelling.
And that was very helpful of the judge in his charge. You may remember Justice Tony Hunt told the jurors, he acknowledged that there were inconsistencies in some of the eyewitness accounts, and he pointed out that that happens in traumatic incidents, and he talked about the frailties of human memories and the levels of recall in those kind of circumstances. But he also described the camera as a witness, and he said the camera can be a good witness and it can be a bad witness, and he was talking about the quality of footage, and he was speaking about the CCTV compilation, and he said, you know, where there is an inconsistency in a piece of evidence, go back, look at the CCTV. And I think that may have been a useful reference tool. But again, what I thought was interesting when he was summing up the evidence the other day was that Justice Hunt didn't go through that whole 1 hour compilation. He just focused on the attack itself. And I must say, in all the years that I have been covering dreadful stories in the criminal courts, watching that CCTV footage was really haunting and unsettling. And when it was played and it was just the speed, the ferocity of the attack, it was, you could hear a pin drop. Nobody reacted after seeing that footage. And what really struck me about it was watching this compilation, because there had been a build-up. That was the last clip played. There had been a build-up. It took an hour for that compilation to be shown in full. And what was really difficult was you're watching that footage and it is an ordinary day. People are out shopping. You see Riyad Bouchaker's movements. He's coming and going. It's busy on Parnell Square. You see the children. You're getting closer to the event. And you know what's going to happen. So that kind of contrast between this otherwise ordinary day and you know that so many lives are going to be upended. You see and you hear about the lifelong and life-limiting injuries that the most seriously injured girl suffers with and will suffer with for the rest of her life. You know that in a couple of minutes, a couple of seconds, you know what's going to happen. But it's still, nothing prepares you for seeing that footage. It was a really difficult watch. And that's, for me, a reporter who is paid to cover these dreadful stories. I cannot imagine what that was like for the family sitting behind us. It must have been incredibly difficult.
Would they have seen that before?
It's a good question.
I think probably not. No.
Very hard.
I don't think so.
I think
very
that generally hard. Speaking, their families are warned this is coming. Mm. And if you don't feel like you're going to be able for it, you maybe step outside. Most people don't. And it's surprising. Well, and maybe it's not surprising, but very often when people see CCTV footage of these kinds of events for the first time, it is overwhelming for them and they do break down and they aren't really able for it, even if they might think they will be able for it before they see it. I agree with Frank there. What happened when that CCTV was shown was that the entire courtroom just went quiet. There was a stunned silence. I think the jury went out not long after it had been shown, and I don't think anyone moved for a little considerable period. And then I do remember turning around and seeing the just shocked and drawn faces of the families who had just watched it. It seemed to me they had probably never seen it before, and they didn't realize how shocking it was going to be.
Really difficult, like anybody.
Yes, and of course as well, I mean, you know, you heard the evidence that he went out that day intending to kill children, and it just happened to be where this first child was standing, at what position she was standing in the line, and they must have been watching that footage thinking, you know, that could have been any one of our kids. Mm. And as Frank said, you know, you're watching something where you know the outcome.
You know what's coming.
You know what's coming and you know the outcome. Approaching 3 years down the line of where this little girl is now. Because this case would have been so different if we're looking at three attempted murder charges
And if you had three children who luckily got off with injuries that were not life-threatening. But I just think it's those days that we heard about the evidence, and it was the trial was bookended with the evidence regarding the five-year-old girl who was so seriously injured. It started with her mother. The trial ended with that medical evidence, which I think was some of the most harrowing evidence I've heard in a long time. I mean, you were just waiting for the doctors who treated her that day and who have been treating her since to say something positive, because it just was so hard to listen to. But really what they ended up saying is talking about all the struggles she had. And one thing that really struck me and I thought was just horrendous was actually the pain she was in after and the management of that. But then saying that, you know, her condition is actually going to get worse as she grows up, or she may be at risk of other infections or other issues, was just so hard to hear. But you can just imagine for the other families, they must have been watching that footage thinking that could have been any of us in that boat right now.
Mm.
Yeah. Moving on to the other footage that was part of this case, the Garda interviews being shown in court took up several days of evidence. Looking back, how significant do you think they were?
Well, they probably supported the defence more so than the prosecution, in the sense that it was part of the defence's case that Riyad Bouchaker was insisting that he didn't intend to kill, obviously, and that's one of the most essential ingredients in an attempt to murder charge. And repeatedly throughout those Garda interviews, those seven Garda interviews, he said he wasn't in his right mind, he didn't intend to kill, he didn't intend to harm. It was almost like a mantra. Now, the decision was made, I think, but don't know for sure, by the defence to play the recordings of those. That doesn't always happen, where you have the video recording played for the jury. It doesn't always happen because it takes much longer than having a guard in the witness box reading from a memo or a transcript of the interview. So it saves time to do it that way. But the decision was made because I think the defence wanted the jury to see the cognitive impairments that they had spoken about in relation to Riyad Bouchaker. And that was plain to see in those interviews, particularly the earlier ones. But as the guards would say, and as the prosecution said, he was able to follow, he was able to remember, he was able to recall certain things until it potentially didn't suit him. And then all of a sudden, I think gibberish was a word that was used to describe some of the replies to guard the questioning. But you could see they were giving him every chance. They were, the Gardaí who interviewed him were very conscious of his difficulties. He had brain surgery in 2021. Complications arose as a result of that. That was 2 years before the incident. They were exacerbated then by the intervention of members of the public on the day of the attack itself. So the Gardaí were very aware of that. They waited until he had been properly assessed in hospital before they arrested him and took him in for questioning. But what was really interesting to see was the final interview, when I think it was Detective Garda Conor Moran, and all of a sudden, okay, they're running out of time. Not that there was a desperate last-ditch effort, but suddenly the conversation stopped being about, tell us what you remember, tell us what you know. Now it was, this is what we know. This is what we've been told. Look at this CCTV footage. Look at the attack. And he was shown all of this, and he was given every opportunity to admit what he did, and still didn't take it, maintaining that he didn't intend to harm, thanking God ad nauseum for the fact there were no fatalities, kept talking about how glad he was that the kids were okay, and it was pointed out to him in no uncertain terms that the kids were not okay. And I thought it was very powerful for the jury to watch those. So while they may have been put forward to advance the defence's case, I think they actually probably served to do the opposite.
Because the other thing is, without Riyad Bouchaker taking the stand himself, the only time the jury heard Riyad Bouchaker's voice and his explanation was through those Garda interviews.
And in those Garda interviews, you know, I think the jury would have probably also considered that, yes, those Garda interviews took place a month after he was released, a month after the incident itself, after he had been released from hospital. But of course, when he committed these crimes, he did not have that second injury to his brain. So he was not in the same condition he was in when those interviews were carried out, which was a really interesting aspect of that case, because even throughout the trial, when you were looking at his demeanour in court, where you're thinking that same person you know, it wasn't the exact same person who carried out this attack, because, you know, he's now since had another injury to his brain. So that is perhaps something the jury could have taken into account. I think another issue potentially in those interviews, when you are hearing everything through a translator, I don't think you really got a sense of, you know, things like inflection or how someone is actually expressing what they're saying, because that's very hard to do when it's not the person talking. So even when you have someone saying things like he's saying, thank God, you know, the children are still alive, I think it's very hard to actually interpret how that is coming across. But I certainly think from watching those interviews, you know, I don't think the jury would have had any sympathy for him.
You've just reminded me of a moment during the playing of that recording where it was off camera, so you couldn't see the clips that the Gardaí were showing Riyad Bouchakar in that final interview. But he was shown, as I say, the clip of the attack itself, and the interpreter who was seated next to him couldn't actually watch it. I don't know, did either of you his response? He recoiled.
Yeah, no, he did. He recoiled from, I don't think he realized until that point precisely what he had, what he was there for, and what this was, what this involved. Probably striking also that the same interpreter was not with him in court.
Okay.
Let's talk about some of the things the jury didn't hear. Owen, what would stand out for you? There wasn't a huge amount of legal argument in this case, but there were some things that the jury were not aware of throughout this trial.
Yeah, the jury were actually let know about things that in ordinary course of things they probably wouldn't, such as that Riyad Bouchakar had been subject of a fitness to stand trial hearing, pre-trial hearing. Those things are not usually told to a jury, but they were in this case, I suppose, because the jury needed to be made aware that this man did have these, you know, cognitive difficulties at this point. But during the trial, the main piece of legal argument that happened in the absence of the jury was when the defence applied to have two of the attempted murder charges withdrawn by the judge, that he would order an acquittal in relation to those. Now, the judge obviously did not agree to do that. But their argument in relation to that was simply that, in one case, that there wasn't enough evidence that Riyad Bouchakar had actually inflicted the injury. This was a less than 1 centimetre laceration to the throat of one of the boys, subject of an attempted murder charge. They said that that may have been caused in the ordinary rough and tumble of a child's life, and that it was a small or insignificant injury, and there was no proof that it had even been caused by a knife. So they argued that there was insufficient evidence in relation to that to prove that Riyad Bouchakar had actually inflicted it. They also did ask for the assault causing harm charges as well against the two children to be removed from the indictment. But again, the judge found in relation to these that really the jury was entitled to look at a broader picture in relation to them, that there was, from the CCTV, from the injuries that the children suffered from, the act of a large man with a very large knife attacking children who are naturally weak and frail compared to him and compared to the knife, that there was, they could look at that broader picture and infer an intent from that, and as well as the injuries that the children suffered, that they didn't need to just look at one or the other, that that broader picture gave rise to that intent. And so he dismissed the applications, and all of those charges went to the jury as they were. The only difference being that he did agree that there should be alternative verdicts in relation to those charges. And the reason for that, as he said, was that if the jury were not satisfied that the very high bar for attempted murder had been reached by the prosecution, he didn't want the jury in a situation where they could only acquit and didn't have any other option. So in relation to the first attempted murder charge where the child suffered those catastrophic injuries, he offered the alternative to the jury that they could return a finding of intentionally or recklessly causing serious harm. I think that's clear why he would offer that. Causing serious harm clearly happened in that case. In relation to the other two who did not really suffer serious harm, the alternative that the jury were given was an assault causing harm, but didn't come to that in the end. So, yeah.
And I was going to just clarify that timeline. That was what happened last Friday. It was towards the end of the trial that these applications were made. How common is that?
Has to be at the end of, for those specific directions where you're looking for charges to be thrown out, because the argument that a defence is going to make is that the prosecution hasn't met a threshold in terms of it would be unsafe for the evidence presented. It would be unsafe for this charge to go to a jury. So inevitably, the jury has to hear all of the evidence before such an application can be made. And I must say, in terms of like things that the jury didn't hear. There wasn't a hell of a lot of that, because this was a very smooth trial in terms of very little legal argument. As Owen mentioned, the fitness to stand trial took place a couple of months ago, and they were given a broad overview in terms of the evidence presented at that by forensic psychiatrists and obviously the outcome. And they were also told that he had been assessed for criminal insanity, and both psychiatrists found that he didn't meet the threshold for that particular special verdict, whereby a person can be found not guilty of a crime by reason of insanity. But aside from that, I don't think there was an awful lot. There were moments, I suppose, during the trial that the jury would have possibly seen, but that we couldn't clearly talk about. And one of those moments that that struck me was after one of the alleged victims, a man who we can now identify, the brave young Frenchman that we were speaking about on the podcast, Alan Lorraine Gill. We couldn't identify him previously because at 17 years of age when this happened, he was technically a child victim, and under the Children Act, without getting into the weeds on it, we couldn't identify him. We have since received his consent to identify him. He's now come of age, obviously, and he should be named, and he should be absolutely commended for what he did that day in disarming Riyad Bushikr, and again, putting himself in harm's way to do so. But after giving his evidence, he travelled from France to give his evidence, to be there, to give his evidence, immaculately dressed, I must say. I think he was wearing a three-piece suit, giving his evidence on a hot day in the middle of the heat wave. And after he had finished giving his evidence, as he was passing the dock, he stopped, he paused, and he looked, glared at Riyad Bushikr, faced his attacker, faced the man who has now been found guilty of trying to kill those children, causing horrendous damage to Leanne Flynn. He was the catalyst for what happened on the streets of Dublin later that night. And this young Frenchman, again, just 17 years of age at the time, on his way to his job in Dublin city centre at the time, and he stands there glaring at the accused. It was a very, and it was a moment.
It was very obvious. It was very.
It was a moment. Yeah. It was. And I don't think the jury could have possibly missed it. We couldn't talk about it at the time because that could have obviously infiltrated the jury room in terms of prejudice and whatnot. But I remember afterwards, the some of the parents of some of the child victims approached me and said, "Did you see that?" I said, "How could you possibly have missed it?" Mm. It was, I just thought it was brilliant.
Such
was
strength of character.
Yeah.
Really. And so still such a young man.
Yeah.
And even in his evidence, the way he minimised what happened to him and his role and all of that. Like, he's a humble guy.
It was described as Gaelic indifference by the defence counsel because, yeah, he just, when he was asked about what injuries he had, he said, "Well, it was nothing. It was nothing. I had a little scratch on my finger, a nick on my face."
And I wonder, did Carol Finnegan, the prosecuting barrister, want him to kind of maybe like elaborate a bit? Because obviously the prosecution had to prove in his case that harm had been caused. Now, granted, minimal injuries is still technically harm, but when he was saying, but 'twas a scratch, you know, that was kind of his attitude, and he just went to his character, I think.
Yeah. Humble. There was another witness who gave evidence one day, and I won't name him just in case he doesn't want to be named, but in the witness box he was very definitive. I wouldn't say he was particularly emotional. He gave his evidence very directly, very succinctly. Came across as someone I probably describe as, you know, a very strong man. And we saw as he was leaving, he was getting into the lift. One of the family members went up to thank him, and he broke down in tears. And I remember thinking at the time he was given his evidence, I was like, this is just someone who does not want to get emotional. And you could see, I think during the trial, you could see a lot of witnesses really trying to, I suppose, fight back that emotion.
Of course.
Because they all came there. You know, you come to court to testify, to do a job.
Yeah.
But you even had experienced paramedics who have seen it all. And as they were giving their evidence, particularly in relation to the emergency treatment that the most seriously injured girl received at the scene, and they were choking back tears, and they were clearly very emotional as they were being catapulted back to that moment. And that's what's so difficult about these things. You know, when people have to get up and relive those traumatic experiences, like take, for example, that girl's mother. She was an excellent witness, by the way. But at moments, she understandably broke down. And I don't know how she found the strength to get up there and to give that evidence. The same could be said for the likes of Leanne Flynn. They should be immensely proud of what they did and how they presented themselves in the witness box, because it was remarkable to see.
I think particularly with Leanne Flynn, I mean, it's one thing to act, to do what she did on the day, but the strength she showed in the witness box. You know, she was just, again, you know, very little emotion, very factual. She was the prosecution's key witness in this case. I think her evidence was absolutely crucial. And everything she said was so important. But she, yeah, she really was a really good witness for the prosecution.
And what was important there is because we've said that a lot of the eyewitnesses just plain got things wrong. And, you know, that could be proven by, you know, reference to CCTV or medical evidence. But Leanne Flynn didn't get things wrong. She actually remembered things accurately as they did, as they really happened. And she was very clear in particular in that when, after she had been cast aside and she was cross-examined on this, she was very clear that Bushko was trying to get back at the children and that he was still striking and stabbing and that, you know, it wasn't it couldn't be characterized in the way that the defense had tried to characterize it, that he was simply waving a knife in the general direction. She knew, she could see that he was hell-bent on getting back at the children. And she had been so clear in all of her evidence and she was so careful in it that there was no real questioning her evidence. There's no way to countermand it.
And obviously she was cross-examined by Bushaker's defense barrister and he had to put certain things to her because, as you rightly point out, she was a key prosecution witness. But she wasn't returning. She was adamant that she saw what she saw. And sometimes in the heat of the moment, like, witnesses can collapse under cross-examination. And to be fair to Mr. Bushaker's barrister, I think he was very tactful in his approach with these prosecution witnesses. In fairness, he was. He had a job to do. He had a case to put forward. He had questions to ask. But she was absolutely certain of her account and she wasn't returning under cross-examination.
Something we haven't mentioned yet. Mr. Bushaker's barrister.
Yeah. This mysterious, this unidentified man.
Unnamed. Let's talk about that for a second.
Well, I mean, it's clear through the podcast and through the coverage of this trial that Mr. Bushaker's defence barrister has been referred throughout as Mr. Bushaker's defence barrister. He hasn't been named or identified in any way. And there isn't some wild conspiracy. The reason he hasn't been named is because we haven't been allowed to name him or any of the defence legal team. An order was put in place a long time ago by a district court judge for the safety of legal representatives because, for obvious reasons, given the aftermath, given what he did for starters, but given what happened thereafter on the streets of Dublin, and I'm talking about the Dublin riots, there was a fear at the time that Riad Bushaker was charged and brought before the courts that if the identities of the legal team representing him, again, they're just doing their job. You mightn't like it, but they're just doing their job. The court decided that they shouldn't be identified. So a court order was actually put in place. So if we were to name any of them during the podcast or indeed here on this particular episode, we would actually be in contempt of court. No grand conspiracy. That's why. And I suppose we couldn't mention that at the time or explain it because it could potentially be seen as prejudicial. You know, if juror potentially, even though they shouldn't, maybe listening to the podcast might look into that in a certain way. So we just had to ignore it.
I don't think I've come across a trial before where we haven't been able to name defence teams. I don't recall that being the case. And I suppose just as an aside, I don't think probably the debate that happened during the last presidential election would have been helpful in this case because maybe people don't understand, as Frankie explained there, about the cab rank rule that barristers don't choose who they get to represent and that any accused, any defendant, you know, is entitled to representation. And if they're pleading not guilty, you know, they need a barrister when the case is going to trial.
I think it's also important for people to remember that a defence barrister's job is not real. There's an attitude that their job is to get people off and to get people off unfairly. That's not their job. Their job is to stress test the prosecution's case. That's all they're there to do. They're there to test whether the evidence has been properly gathered, whether it is admissible in a trial, you know, if it has been lawfully and properly gathered, and then to stress test whether or not it actually proves what the prosecution claims it proves. That's it. And in this case, they did that. They tested it. They made their arguments. And by and large, those arguments were rejected both by the judge and by the jury in the end. But that is the legal process working exactly as it's supposed to work. The fact that this man has a defence just means that we know that the prosecution has done its job properly. And despite all the efforts of his lawyers, they haven't been able to pick those holes in the prosecution case. And that's the legal system working perfectly.
And the judge even acknowledged to Mr. Bushaker's defence barrister that he had a difficult job. And I think, in fairness to him, he was very tactful, as I say, in his approach to witnesses. And he also didn't shy away from the horror of what his client did and what he has now been found to have done by a jury of his peers. He described it at various points as horrific, as abhorrent. He didn't shy away from that in any way. But as Owen has pointed out, he had a job to do, and that was stress testing the evidence. And it's just essential for somebody like Riyad Boushikar in our justice system that he receives a fair trial. And I don't think you can make the argument that he didn't.
If you were to describe Riyad Boushikar's demeanour throughout this case.
Well, can I just say, for a start, obviously because he has this cognitive impairment, you know, it's a little bit difficult to assess him, you know, as you might assess an ordinary person who doesn't have that cognitive impairment. It was mentioned by a psychiatrist who assessed him prior to the trial that he has this inappropriate jocularity, that he would laugh at inappropriate times, that he didn't seem to really understand the gravity, the seriousness of the charges that he faced. And that was kind of apparent during the trial. There were times when he would burst into laughter at something that he had said himself to his interpreter. Now, I've obviously no idea what he was saying to the interpreter that he thought was so funny, but that happened throughout the trial, and it did happen at very inappropriate moments. It even happened, we've mentioned that moment when the entire courtroom was in stunned silence after the first time everyone saw the CCTV footage. Within a minute or so of that, I do remember Riyad Boushikar bursting into laughter again at something he had said himself. But I don't think he was really aware of the other people in court and the impact that this had had on them. I don't think there was any kind of calculation in what he was doing. I think it was just he has this inability to really understand the gravity and the seriousness of the situation as it unfolded, you know, as the court case unfolded and the seriousness of the things that he had done.
But very surreal to be in the courtroom, I would imagine, and hear that.
The juxtaposition.
Yes. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Certainly. Yeah. Some of the most, you know,
well, the medical evidence as well that was heard at the very end, the extensive evidence in relation to the horrendous injuries that poor little girl will now spend the rest of her life living with. At times during that as well, he could be seen in the dock smiling and laughing and trying to engage with his interpreter. And again, as Owen has pointed out, in the fitness to stand trial hearing, that condition was brought to the court's attention. So you have to give the man the benefit of the doubt because, you know, to think that somebody would sit through that and watch that footage and find it amusing is just beyond, you know, horrific. So, yeah, there were moments, and that must have been very upsetting for the family. And, you know, I hope that they were aware of that condition. It wasn't mentioned in court, but there were really inappropriate moments where he seemed to be finding things amusing.
Yeah, sorry, I was just going to say that, when the family noticed, I think they did notice that he was laughing, and that I think that added to their level of maybe shock and anger at what they were experiencing at that point. That it seemed to me anyway, just observing them.
I think there's perhaps a certain element. You would wonder, you know, how much comprehension and understanding he has now of what he has done. And now the fact he's been convicted of 8 counts, I mean, you know, we can't put ourselves inside his mind, so we don't know.
We can't, but I did notice when he, if you may remember, after the jury's business was done yesterday, after they delivered their verdicts and they were sent away with a 25-year jury exemption, Mr. Justice Hunt rose for a few minutes and the court settled down. And when he came back, then we, obviously there was a conversation about sentencing. And in that interim, Riyad Boushikar was taken back out of the courtroom for a few minutes. And when he returned, he appeared to me anyway, from where I was seated, it appeared that he had been crying. And he did seem agitated when the prison officers were taking him away. I do recall as he was being led away once the sentence hearing date had been set and he was being taken away to be remanded in custody. He did say, take it easy to a prison officer who by no means, from what I could see, was manhandling him in any sort of a way that would be inappropriate. He was simply leading him out of the courtroom, and he did seem agitated as he was leaving at that point.
I think the mother of the most seriously injured girl, when she gave her interview to Sky News yesterday with Stephen Murphy, and he asked her if she could forgive Riyad Boushikar, and she said she doesn't think he understands what he did. and she doesn't feel anger towards him. I mean, I find that remarkable. And I think I commend her for having such dignity and such understanding. Humanity. Oh, humanity. To be able to say that after what she's facing and her daughter is facing for the rest of her life, to have that compassion for the man we've just described as there are limitations there, and yet he is responsible for upending their entire world.
And I think it's worth noting, though, as well, that we are talking about Riad Bhushikar now since this happened. At the time when he did it, he had a very mild cognitive impairment. In other words, he knew what he was doing at that time. And he very much knew that he was attacking children. He knew that it was wrong to attack children. And he knew what the consequences of that attack would be. And he had formed an intention in his mind. He had, you know, deliberately planned this out. So it's important, I think, to make a distinction between the Riad Bhushikar who committed these acts and the Riad Bhushikar as he is now, which is, I suppose, a different individual now.
You know, you'd wonder, and, you know, fortunately, we're not in the scenario that that mother is in. But, you know, do you have to look at this? There is no doubt, you know, what was done to those children that day was, it was an evil act. But do you separate the act from the person? I don't know. You know,
I think if she had come out, and I watched that interview on Sky, and I think if she had come out and she said, yes, I am angry with that man and I will never forgive him, I don't think anybody would have bat an eyelid, because that, I mean, what was actually starting for me was that she didn't say that, because that's what you expect her to say.
Exactly.
So, like, anger, I suppose, is such a toxic emotion, and to live with that day in, day out doesn't help her and certainly doesn't help her daughter. So, wow, like,
She's an incredible woman.
An incredible woman. And I'm just catapulted back again to her evidence. I think she was the first prosecution witness called. And just as she was giving her evidence, like, I have kids, two wonderful little babas. I know all about creche drop-offs. And what struck me from her evidence was that up to a point, and again, it's like watching that CCTV footage, knowing what's about to unfold, and listening to her just describing the ordinariness of the day, getting up, and there's a sliding doors moment too, because either herself or her daughter wasn't feeling well that day.
She wasn't going to go to work.
And ended up going to work. And, you know, you obviously can't go there, but there's that sliding doors moment. And then she speaks in great detail about dropping her daughter off, going to work, doing a coffee run, having meetings, and then getting a phone call from the after school, the owner of the after school facility. And, you know, you drop your kids off a creche and you don't expect to hear from them again until you pick them up. And when you get a phone call, you know something's wrong. And it could be, you know, child is upset or sick or whatever. You don't expect to get a phone call from the owner of the after school care in tears telling you that your child has been stabbed. And then following her on her journey as she frantically ran out the door, within minutes was at the scene, and she's describing that scene, the cordon, all of the things that you expect to see at a scene like that, you know, ambulances, Gardaí, huge crowd gathered at that point, all of those things, perfectly normal. She sees paramedics working on somebody. She didn't know it was her daughter until she saw her daughter's pink shoes and her pink backpack. And that, for me, was gut-wrenching. It was like a punch in the stomach, because you don't expect to see those things at a crime scene. And she obviously knew at that point, there's nothing that I can do for my daughter in this moment. Let them do their work. And wow, like, what work they did, because as Owen mentioned earlier, she was clinically dead. You know, highly experienced consultant was on the scene within minutes. And when he was asked what he thought of the situation, when he assessed her, he said in no uncertain terms to the jury, I thought she was dead. He was right. She was dead.
And I think that's one of the most tragic things about this case is, despite the best efforts by people, by doctors who happened to just come upon the scene, despite where this attack took place, that it was fortunately so close to a hospital, they were able to get blood to the child within minutes. They were able to get her to Temple Street. And despite all those efforts, this girl has been left with this lifelong injury. And I think, you know, that's just one of the parts of this trial that is so difficult. And I think this case has been, you know, perhaps one that just so many people, it's very difficult to comprehend. It's very difficult to think about a case where children could be attacked in broad daylight on a normal Thursday afternoon in Dublin City. You know, when this happened first, it almost had the hallmarks of a terror attack. It wasn't. We heard in court he was a lone actor. He was someone who went out that day, we don't know for what reason. Was he described as being upset? He described it as having a blackout. You know, I think the defence said it was banal frustration and inexplicable madness is what they said, I think. But we don't know what was going on in his mind, but it is still just so difficult to comprehend why he did what he did and, yeah, the tragic outcome that it has led to.
And I think the unsung heroes of that day is another thing. The serendipitous nature of medical personnel being flagged down by passers-by, like you say, Rotunda Hospital being so nearby.
Oh, I ran from the Rotunda.
Ran to do what they could. And the emergency care that they gave that little girl on the footpath, those unsung heroes, the people who then were willing to go and testify and give evidence, a very difficult thing to do. But they are the other part of this story is actually... Somebody was saying that we saw the best of Dublin and the worst of Dublin that day.
I think Siobhan Carney summed it up really well in her evidence. She'd been attending the Stardust inquest that day. Her brother died in the fire and, you know, she described running across the road straight away when she saw the attack unfolding. And, you know, she was screaming, get the kids away. And she said in the witness box, protect the children. It's in our constitution. And she had no second thoughts. And I think, you know, she later said, it's not about my life being put in danger. You know, and I think she sums up all the good people that are out there in this world. And she sums up the people who came upon, you know, that scene.
Well, aside from her brave intervention, you know, like a firefighter running into the burning building as everybody is running away from it. Like she engaged, she was grabbing, she was jumping on Riad Bushikr. She was screaming. She was trying to get the children away because they were still exposed as far as she was concerned. So, There's that incredibly brave woman doing that thing. But then as the crowd grew and people were trying to get in at Riad Bushikr after he had been knocked to the ground, she was one of a few women who stood in front of him to protect him. You know, she said, we are not savages here. And she clearly didn't want to see justice being dished out on the streets. She wanted to see justice being served in a courtroom. And if she and others hadn't done that, I don't know if that would have happened, because that was a very angry crowd of people that had gathered, understandably, given what had happened beforehand.
And it's also striking, like we've spoken about the level of compassion shown by that girl's mother. We've shown the incredible things that paramedics did at the scene. There was a member of the public who is the first person to have attempted CPR on this girl. I don't know who that was. They didn't give evidence in the trial. I don't know if they were ever tracked down. But the first paramedic who arrived there, who happened to be driving by and just got out of his ambulance when he saw that there was a girl lying on the ground, he was assisted by that person until advanced paramedics arrived. And you have all these people doing incredible things. There was a doctor who happened to be cycling by. I think he was on his way to Temple Street and he stopped. He went to see what was happening and he helped to insert a tube into the girl's throat so that she could breathe. The decision was taken to get her to Temple Street immediately. She was put in the ambulance. She got a blood transfusion because another doctor had come from the Rotunda and ordered blood immediately. So she got a blood transfusion in the ambulance. They got the doctor who had inserted the tube in her throat, ran to Temple Street to tell the emergency department, this child is not coming to you. We're going straight to theatre. Cleared a theatre as best he could. Told someone to get on the phone to the matter to send a cardiothoracic surgeon because they don't have one in Temple Street. All these people were doing these amazing things and they did save that girl's life. You know, they carried out life-saving heart surgery on her that within 40 minutes of this happening. And they did all these things while outside that hospital, people were setting fire to the city, were causing criminal damage. There were online agitators who, I hope they realize the difference between the actions of these people at the scene who actually did things that helped and the things that they instigated people to do, because the juxtaposition, you know, it couldn't be starker.
And I know the girl's mother referred to that in the piece that she did with Stephen Murphy. She said that, you know, she could hear the riots in the hospital, and she wasn't born in Ireland. I don't believe her husband was born in Ireland, you know, so would those people technically class them as immigrants as well? There was so much damage already done by what happened on Parnell Square East that day that, what happened later on in that day is just, it's hard to comprehend.
But you look, and this is something that was abundantly clear, but expressly pointed out to the jury as well, is that many nationalities came to the children's rescue. You're talking about the Brazilian delivery rider, Caio Benicio, who struck him with his helmet. The Frenchman that we've already mentioned, Alan Lorraine Gill, they all came to the assistance. They didn't think twice about getting involved. And there were also other people. You talk about unsung heroes. I mean, everybody, I think, had heard about Caio Benicio. There was a GoFundMe page set up for him, go buy him a pint or whatever for what he did, hundreds of thousands of euro raised. But there were plenty of people that maybe didn't make the headlines at the time that deserve huge credit for what they did. Warren Donoghue was one of them. He was out with his family that afternoon, heard a commotion, saw what was going on, didn't think twice, intervened, punched Riyad Bouchagar, knocking him to the ground. And when he was asked why he did that, he said he had to be put down. So he was there, Caio Benicio was there, and he was like a superhero coming off his motorbike, from what I've been told by all accounts, coming down the road, seeing what was going on. I don't think his motorbike had even stopped, and he was off it, and he was straight into it. And you hear about all of these, Siobhan Carney's evidence was fantastic. You know, to think that you'd like to think you would do the exact same thing in that moment, but you just don't know. Like, it's classic fight or flight, and these people fought. You know, there were many others who didn't, and that's fine too, because as I say, we don't know how we would have responded in that incident. But let's give huge credit to Leanne Flynn, because at one point, as Riyad Bouchagar was ad nauseam repeatedly saying, thank God the kids are okay, one of the Gardaí, I think it was Detective Moran, actually stopped him and said, when you're talking about those kids and the fact that they're okay, as you put it, and there haven't been fatalities, don't thank God, thank Leanne. Because she was the one, I've no doubt in my mind, that if she didn't intervene, and watching that footage as well, seeing her grappling with Riyad Bouchagar, seeing the knife then produced in court, 32 centimetres, very long blade, a carving knife. Like, to see that in his hand, a big man like Riyad Bouchagar, and she still went to protect the children. Like, it's incredible.
It seemed to me as well that she tried, even after she had been stabbed, she tried to get back at him. That was what it looked like to me on the CCTV. Now, at that stage, I don't think that she would have been physically capable of anything by then.
But she had been stabbed in the back at that point.
She had been, you know, she had a punctured lung, she had a severed spleen, and she had a punctured diaphragm. So there was no way she was going to be able to do anything, but she still tried to get back at him. But I think at that point, she kind of fell to the ground and wasn't able to do any more. Without her intervention, Frank is absolutely right. I think we'd be talking about fatalities and quite a few.
And we actually had, Deborah and I had a lovely moment as we were stepping out to go for a coffee on one of the days, and we just happened to be crossing the road at the same time as Leanne Flynn was. And at various points throughout the trial, you know, where the opportunity arose, I thought about going over just to commend her for her bravery. Didn't think it was appropriate. But just in this moment, I didn't want to see the opportunity lost. We went over, and just with no ulterior motive, we just wanted to tell her how brave she was and how she was a hero, and she is a hero. And she's very humble. Like, she didn't say much to us as we crossed the road that afternoon. But she is a hero, because I do genuinely think that more children would have been harmed, seriously harmed, if not worse, if she hadn't put her life on the line. And she is suffering the consequences as a result.
Yeah. Well, I think the last group, just to mention, for who are due, I think, credit, the jury. They did their duties. They have come back with guilty verdicts. The next step now will be sentencing. We know it's happening in October. Very briefly, I just want to get your thoughts about how easy or difficult is this going to be. There's 8 charges for him to consider and sentencing. What would you expect for the judge?
I think the biggest thing that he's going to have to grapple with is Riyad Bouchagar's ongoing cognitive impairment. That is going to be the biggest mitigating factor. Usually when it comes to sentencing, the biggest mitigating factor that a person might have would be a guilty plea. You don't have that in this case. I think if you look through, you know, all of the how this happened, the fact that he targeted children, et cetera, it would be very hard to see how anything less than a life sentence would be imposed. And that is the maximum sentence that it's available on 4 of the charges. That's the 3 attempted murder and the causing serious harm to Leanne Flynn. But it will be interesting to hear what pleas are made by the defence in relation to that and how the judge takes those on board.
Deborah, would you expect to see victim impact statements of some kind?
Absolutely. I think the only thing we have to wait for is perhaps will we hear victim impact statements from the children? They would now be 7 or 8 years old. The judge said they will have the opportunity to give victim impact evidence if they want. We obviously didn't hear evidence from the children during the trial. We heard from their parents. I think if it's the children or the parents, I think, yeah, listening to that evidence will be another harrowing day in court, but important to see that justice is done.
Yeah. So, Frank, we'll be back on the 12th of October. That's the date that's been set down for Riad Bhushikar's sentence hearing. And we'll bring you whatever Mr. Justice Tony Hunt hears on that date.
Yep. And as it turns out, we'll actually be back before then, because Josef Puska's appeal against his conviction for the murder of Ashley Murphy is due to take place later this month. So keep an eye out for that.
That's it for episode 17 of All Rise, the Riad Bhushikar trial.
Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow us or subscribe to the podcast.
All Rise, the Riad Bhushikar trial.
A News Talk original podcast.
Was hosted by Frank Graney and Aisling Moore. Follow the podcast on newstalk.com, on the Go Loud app, or wherever you get your podcasts.